When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to writer, podcaster, activist, and mother, Renee Von Medding.
And recently she started talking about it all the time to anyone who will listen. She'd be like, yeah, and when I was born and I was in mom's tummy, and then the doctor took me, and then I was an embryo, and then I was in mama's tummy, and then she was trying to push me out and I got really big, and then I was getting tired. And she like recounts the whole labor, and then the doctor needed to help to pull my head out because it was too big. She loves brilliant. It, but she just loves the fact that she was in mom's tummy and then she was in mama's tummy.
Renee lives in Dublin city centre with her wife Audrey and their two daughters, Ava who's 4 and Aria who's 2. And she spoke about so much during our chat, from growing up in an extremely religious household, the importance of having boundaries, her struggles with an eating disorder, how she met and fell in love with Audrey, and their beautiful but challenging journey to motherhood. She's also the CEO of non-profit organisation Equality for Children. And I hope when you listen to this conversation that you'll feel as strongly as I do and want to support their efforts by signing the petition that you'll find in the show notes. Here's our conversation. Renee, you're very welcome, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Right, so first up, you're Irish, but you weren't born here.
No. I was born in Chicago, and we moved here when I was 4. So I've grown up here, and it's a funny thing because depending on who I'm talking to, they'll be like, oh, you're not Irish. And I'm like, well, I am Irish.
Yeah.
You know, even like I've lived up on James's Street for my entire adult life. You know, middle of Dublin, and a lot of times even now, you know, people will be like treating me like a tourist. I'm like, I've lived here for like 13 years.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
But you've never lost the accent.
See, my mom has a very strong accent.
Ah, okay.
And I think, you know, growing up on the south side of Dublin, everyone has a bit of an American twang, you know, watching all the TV we did growing up.
So moving here at 4, do you have memories of it?
My first memory, and I'm sure I have a lot of suppressed memories, but we won't go into that. That's a whole other topic. But my first like memory that I am aware of is the Dublin airport.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Dublin airport when we arrived and getting into a big van. I was the youngest of 4 siblings. It was my mom and the 4 of us. My dad actually passed away when I was 2 in Chicago. He had colon cancer and died at 31.
Oh God, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so we moved here just with her and the 4 of us. And I just remember getting into this big van and all of these suitcases. And it was really chaotic, but it was really exciting. And just being in this place that was like just so unknown.
Yeah. And so I would imagine extremely different.
Very different, yeah. Yeah. You know, throughout my childhood, we would have gone back and forth to Chicago quite a bit, and we would travel to Florida quite a bit. And it's just worlds apart. I think it's not as different now, but in the early 90s, it was very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was growing up like here for you?
It was interesting because I think, you know, I come from a very religious background, so that very much flavored my childhood. My childhood was all about the church and church events, and that was our life. You know, my mom came over to Ireland as a missionary. She was sent from her church in the States to come to Ireland as a missionary. Okay. So that was like our whole existence kind of revolved around that. Which, you know, later on in life came with a lot of added complications.
Okay.
But I remember, you know, loving where we lived. We lived in Cabin Teely on the south of Dublin, and just a lovely spot to grow up. Even we were there last week when we were allowed to go outside the 20K, and we went to Cabin Teely Park. And I have so many lovely memories of, you know, we were just in there every day.
Yeah.
And it was a gorgeous spot to grow up in.
I know you've touched probably on something very big and whether you want to go there or not. But when you say a very religious background, is it Catholic, Protestant? What religion?
So born again Christian.
OK, yeah.
So I suppose, you know, later on in life, it became a huge issue because I was very much, and I think for most children who grow up in an ultra orthodox or ultra religious setting, you don't know anything else. So that that is what you believe. That is what you believe. Your parents or your parent tells you this is how it is, and that's what you believe. So I was very much a part of that world up until maybe about the age of 15 or so. And I started questioning things, and I was like, I don't think I believe this. And, you know, I don't think that is right. And, you know, for me, I was in, I was a theater kid, and I did all the musicals in school, and I had a lot of friends who were gay. And this was something for me that just always jarred with me, being told that being gay was wrong. Mm. And even though at the time I thought I was straight, that always jarred with me. I was like, but I know these people, and they're just like me. There's no difference. So that was something that always jarred with me, and then lots of other things. And I just became very disillusioned with that whole, that whole world.
Yeah.
And I became the black sheep of the family at the time, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I was the youngest one, and I was the rebellious one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty of people listening that are going, tick, I'm that too in my family. And we start to look at family dynamics. There is black sheep in nearly every family I've ever met.
Yes, absolutely. And it changes,
you know,
which is interesting. Sometimes it can change because I'm not necessarily the black sheep anymore.
Okay. You have passed on the baton.
Yes, gratefully.
Okay.
So at the time, my siblings would have been in that world as well.
Yeah.
I think I was probably the first one to break away from it. So that was around the age of 15, 16. We'll talk about this more later. But at the age of 16, I also developed an eating disorder, which was 100% had a lot to do with all of those struggles that were going on.
Yeah.
And that was something I could control. But then when I was 21, I met my now wife. I had always dated boys or men up until then. I had never questioned that. And looking back, I can see that I definitely had attraction to lots of people.
Yeah.
I just didn't realize what that was. But when I met Audrey, I very much knew it was more than just being, you know, attracted as a friend.
Sure.
We started dating secretly. We didn't tell any of my family. Some of our close friends knew. And about 8 months after we had been dating, I had to tell my family. And at the time, all of my family and my siblings were still very much in that world.
Okay.
And that was really, really hard because we had been brought up being told that being gay was akin to being a murderer. You know, it was the worst thing you could be. So that those were really hard conversations. I remember each conversation I had separately with each one of them. And, you know, some of the responses were not what I expected. Where I expected acceptance, I didn't necessarily find it with some of my siblings. And where I expected pushback, there was actually a greater level of empathy than I had expected. So it wasn't at all what I was thinking would happen.
Okay.
With my mom, it was very much what I was thinking would happen, in that she was absolutely devastated, you know. And for years after I told her, she kept trying to change me. She kept trying to say, this is not right. This is not the path for your life. Why don't you just be soulmates, but not have a physical relationship? Because I can see that you are very connected and I can see how happy you make each other, but it's wrong. And that, you know, that's just her religion telling her.
Yeah.
You know, on a personal level, I know even now she can see how right we are for each other and how happy we are and how normal we are.
Yeah.
But her religion just doesn't allow her to kind of get past that.
And still doesn't.
Still doesn't. But I would say that the relationship has healed so much.
Oh, great.
In those years. So we've been together 13 years now. About half of that time was very fraught and very difficult. And I would say that a big shift, there were two very big shifts in the relationship. One was when I went to therapy and realized that I needed to put up boundaries and I needed to say, no, you cannot say these things to me. You cannot, you know, put this on us. If you have views and opinions, they are yours.
Yeah.
I cannot do anything to change how you feel or, you know, anything to do with that. But I can change how I allow you to interact with me. And there was a period of time when I said, I have to cut off contact with you until you learn that that is your life. This is my life and we can coexist peacefully. But I cannot live where, you know, in a situation where every time you see me, you cry and you beg me and you tell me I'm a sinner. And, you know, I can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And I did. I cut off contact for a couple of months. And that was a huge shift, because I think she just kind of realized that if she wanted to be in my life, and I very much wanted her in my life as my only parent.
Yeah.
But she kind of realized that she just kind of had to take a step back and, you know, keep a lid on it, really. You know,
you know what? It shows how strong you are. And what age were you when you went, when, you know, you got to that point? Because boundaries are something that I've touched on in this podcast a lot, because there's something that I, in my personal life, have realized the value of putting them in place. And we all need them.
We do. Like, and people don't realize that they have these kind of codependent relationships with people to varying degrees. And they can be really unhealthy sometimes.
Yes.
You know, and you have to be able to say no. Mm. And you have to be able to step back and you have to say that, you know, I need to keep myself and my immediate family safe here.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you're not safe in a relationship, you know, and that's why you need to put those boundaries in place. I was in my mid-20s and I was kind of on the road to beginning to heal from my eating disorder at that point, which is why I was, you know, accessing therapy at that point.
Great. But look, therapy is a great thing
for everybody.
For everybody.
You don't have to have gone through something huge. Yeah. I think everybody benefits from therapy.
Big time.
The other big shift in the relationship with my mom has been the birth of our kids.
Mm.
And I think kids change people's minds and hearts. You know, they do.
Isn't that amazing? So you can have, you know, you have your these beliefs that are ingrained from your own childhood, perhaps. Which, did she grow up in a born-again Christian background as well?
They would have been, I think, Presbyterian.
Okay.
So they would have gone to church, but no, it was very much something she stumbled upon in her teenage years.
Okay, yeah.
Kind of became indoctrinated.
Sure.
You know, met some really persuasive people and... And I think that is the way it happens sometimes with, you know, extreme religion or, you know, those sorts of worlds, is that people need connection. And when they find like-minded people who, you know, feel like their tribe, it's very easy to be sucked into that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's just, you know, I'm not against anyone believing whatever they want to believe if it gives them a sense of peace and a sense of purpose. But it's when those beliefs start to, you know, exclude people and start to, you know, I suppose, have that idea that your way is the right way.
Yeah.
That's when it becomes problematic.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it hurts people.
Yeah.
But the girls are now in the world, and they, you know, despite what her beliefs were on paper, she's presented with these two gorgeous little girls that are family.
Yeah.
And she loves them.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. She, you know, and if I had spoken to you a couple of years ago, I never would have thought that I would say that she is our number one help.
Okay, brilliant.
Like, we couldn't have gotten through the last couple of years without her. She's our number one babysitter, and they absolutely adore her. And I never would have thought that would have happened.
So great to hear. Yeah. And you know what, as well, it's you know, for somebody listening who is perhaps struggling to put boundaries in place and is aware that they're necessary, but is scared of it, because it is scary. Mm-hmm. It is scary going against the status quo and shaking things up. But you've shown that actually boundaries are healthy, and they can yield really positive results. Does she respect your boundaries now?
She does, very much so. Right. And more so even than I see with my other siblings sometimes. She really respects mine because they were put in place so strongly at the time. And that wasn't easy. Like, that was a really difficult thing to do. But yeah, as you say, the good that came from having to do that is immeasurable. Like, I wouldn't do anything differently. Like, it absolutely needed to happen at the time. And yeah, when I see people with their families and they're kind of struggling with different issues, I'm just like, just respect yourself. You are your own person. No one owns you. You don't have to do something because your siblings are doing it, or you don't have to do something because your parents or your grandparents or your aunties or your uncles. And it's just the thing you do within your family. Like, you are your own person. You make your own way in the world. And, you know, people need to respect that. And if they don't, there's the door.
You're brilliant. I'm just like, I'm getting goosebumps because I can just feel it from you. You're a powerhouse. And I think, you know, as an outsider listening to you and only hearing, you know, a few minutes about family dynamics, and obviously I don't have a clue of anything else, but it feels like while you may be the most challenging of her children with, in terms of the relationship with you and her, as you said, with that comes huge respect, because you are, you know, taking the reins of your own life and saying, okay, I respect myself enough to say no to this.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, Fab, let's go back now. Let's go back to meeting Audrey, because that was really interesting what you said. So you didn't necessarily question it. You were dating boys.
Yeah.
But then you developed this friendship with Audrey.
Yeah.
And then was it like a gradual thing, or was it like a bolt out of the blue?
Literally a bolt.
Was it?
Literally a bolt. And I will never forget that feeling. We had been friends for about a year. We met in college. We were both doing acting, and she was in fourth year. I was in first year. I was, you know, I've matured a lot since then, but at the time I was very much the people pleaser. I wanted everyone to like me. I still have that in me, but I've toned it down a lot. But I was very young and green, and she was like, you know, from Ballyfermot, and she, you know, kind of, we were just so different. And when we struck up this friendship, I know a lot of her friends were like, what are you doing? Like, who is your one? Like, this, like,
from a totally different world.
We're so different. Like, I was very chatty and like wanting to be friends with everyone. She was very like introverted and reserved and just like really cool. Like, didn't really, you know, talk a lot, but like everyone wanted to be around her, you know, that sort of, we were just so different. And it's actually funny how we first kind of started talking was we were paired together for this open day. We used to have these open days in college where we'd put on these most ridiculous, like, restoration costume kind of, like, ridiculous, like, outfits. And, you know, we'd have to go around in character all day and, you know, talk to prospective students who would want to come in the next year. And the director of the college paired the two of us up and told me to put some makeup on her because she never wore makeup.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, put some makeup on her. So we found ourselves in this like bathroom cubicle, me like chatting the ear off her, like putting makeup on her. And she's just like, what is happening right now? But from then on, we just kind of really got on and we were just really fast friends, you know, and there was always a connection there. I just wanted to be around her. but I didn't know what that was. I now know that she always had feelings for me, but she just never went there because she thought I liked guys and that was it.
Yeah, okay.
I knew she had dated both guys and girls and that was never an issue for me at that stage. You know, I was very well into the world of theatre and, you know, a lot of my friends were gay. But it just never occurred to me, yeah. Honestly. Like, looking back, it never occurred to me that I might be physically attracted to her. I just knew that I just, you know, when you just have this connection with someone and you just want to be around them and you, yeah, want to text them, and I just didn't understand it, you know. And it was the day before my birthday, my 21st birthday, and at that stage I had spent a lot of nights with her, like I was like sleepovers,
yeah.
And I was going back to stay in her house or her flat, like she was in Rathmines at the time, and I was going back to stay with her, and up until that point had never had a feeling. And then I remember that night I was lying there, probably a bit drunk, but I was just lying there, and just literally all of a sudden my heart started beating really fast.
Yeah.
And I got so nervous, and I'm not the sort of person to get really nervous about that sort of thing. But I just got really nervous because I knew I felt something and I knew I wanted to say something. But I was like, what? Like, what do I say?
Yeah.
And so she could, like, knew I was tossing and turning. And then finally she's like, Renee, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? And literally what I said, and it took me about 3 or 4 minutes to get the words out, I said, I want to kiss you. And it took me so long to like get the words out. I said it, and then she waited for what seems like about 20 minutes, but probably it was about 20 seconds. And then we kissed, and then, you know, the rest is history.
Oh, lovely.
But it was just, yeah, so unexpected.
And like, did you know in that second that you had that kiss? Oh, yeah, this is meant to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it just felt right. And, you know, in the kind of couple of months after that, when we weren't telling anyone, you know, obviously I struggled a bit with my upbringing, and I'm like, is this really right? Am I doing something wrong?
Okay.
But it never felt, yeah, wrong. There was never a moment that it felt wrong. It always felt completely right, you know? Mm. And I went with that because I was like, how could this be wrong?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we're just two people. Like, who cares what bits we have? And, yeah, that's what I still say now is, like, I don't necessarily, I would identify, I suppose, as queer or gay. I think everyone's a little bit gay, but that's just me.
love it.
But, like, I would never identify.
Do you really think so?
I 100%
think
so.
Come on, this is brilliant.
I just think it's a spectrum. I think it just depends on, it's the person you fall in love with. Because,
okay,
like, I don't know. Like, I just don't.
So we all have a bit of it in us.
I think we do.
Right.
I really do.
Whether we explore it or not.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And whether we're taught, like, all of these kind of gender norms and, like, you know, sex is not gender and gender is not sex. And, you know, people are more fluid than I think we are allowed to believe.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, so I wouldn't identify as a lesbian because I still find men attractive. I just find,
okay,
I always say I find people attractive, you,
yeah,
know, and it's about what is, you know, it's obviously, you know, the physical attraction is there, but it's what is on the inside of a person's soul.
Mm.
Like, what's in their mind? Do they intellectually stimulate you? You know, it's not about what bits they have.
Yes.
I don't think.
Interesting, isn't it? Because, like, I mean, there are labels. Obviously, you've said a few of them there, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are you against labelling?
Not that I'm against labelling, but I don't necessarily like it when people
try and put you in a box.
Yeah. I mean, I have no problem with people, you know, calling me, you know, gay, queer, you know, of the LGBTQ+ community. That's fine. And it's nice, I think, for people to, and sometimes it's helpful for people to have a label.
Okay.
It's helpful for people who maybe have struggled with their sexuality for a long time to finally have a name to put on it.
Okay, yeah.
It can be helpful for people. I suppose I never really struggled with it. It just was something that happened for me. It wasn't,
yes,
like I was hiding for years and years and years and then I was like, oh my God, I just like women. that was never my experience.
Yeah, I getcha.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. So you share your first kiss. You both know, okay, this is it. We've been pals for a good few years at the stage.
We had been really good friends for a year at that stage.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So was there a part of you that was worried that you were going to jeopardize your friendship? Did that ever cross your mind?
I don't think it ever did, because I was, you know, I'm the sort of person who I trust very quickly and I love very quickly. Mm-hmm. Audrey is not.
Okay.
You know, it took her longer to say I love you than it took me, because I knew right away that I loved her.
Hmm.
So it definitely took her longer.
Was that difficult? So you balled out and you said, Audrey, I love you.
Yeah.
Was it like radio silence?
Do you know what? I think that it was like a series of conversations I had with her, because, you know, she's a big Taurus head on her, you know, and she's like, it takes her a while to warm up to you, but once you're in, you're in. You're locked in for life.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had had this conversation and she was like, you know, I'm not going to say I love you until I know. I know.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when she did say it, I knew she meant it.
Okay.
But I suppose just very early on, I kind of just felt like this was it.
Mm.
I just felt like this is my person.
And clearly it is. I mean, you're 13 years on and two girls.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's get into, you know, your journey to motherhood and how beautiful it's been, but also how challenging it's been. No doubt it's been a hugely challenging time for both of you. But you make the decision that you do want to have kids.
And that was very early on. I think we never said we would get married, because at the time we didn't have marriage equality.
Yeah.
So that was never a big priority for us. But we always knew we wanted to have kids. Mm. And we, you know, we talked about that pretty much from the first couple of years. We were like, if we're still together in a few years, we're definitely going to have kids, right? You know, it was just, we both come from, you know, big families, lots of cousins. We both just adore kids. We'd have like 100 of them if we had the money and the help to do it. So we always knew we wanted to have kids. And then I suppose it was when marriage equality was looking likely.
Mm.
That was the time when we were kind of ready to maybe start thinking about kids. So at that time we were like, oh my God, we can have it all. We can get married. We can have a baby. Won't this be amazing? And we knew that we wanted to do some form of fertility treatment so that one of us would carry a baby as opposed to potentially adopt. And we just didn't know how that would look. And one night I think we were having a glass of wine and we were talking about all the permutations of ways it could work. And we were like, wouldn't it be cool, like, if we could use your egg and then I could carry a baby?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be cool? Because then it would like be your genetic baby, but I'd be giving birth and growing the baby. Like, wouldn't that be cool? And, you know, at the time that sounded like science fiction. And then we Googled it and we were like, oh my God, this is a thing. We can do this.
Yeah.
So we learned that that was called reciprocal IVF and we were so excited. We were like, this is amazing. Isn't science great? Isn't it great that we were born when we were and that we're living in this time and it's not 20 years ago? We were just so grateful. We were like, this is amazing. And we went to a clinic in early 2015 and asked about doing that. And we were told that we couldn't do it because they didn't have a license, which was completely bizarre, because they had a license to do egg donation, you know, for heterosexual couples. You could do egg and sperm donation at the time.
Yeah.
But I couldn't use my spouse's genetic material. If she was a man, we could have used her sperm and a donor egg, but we couldn't use her egg and donor sperm.
So the issue was because you're a same-sex couple.
Yeah. So it was that particular treatment, just there was no license for it. So they said, we're really sorry, but we can't do it. So if you want to use your own eggs and do an IUI or an IVF with donor sperm, you can do that here. But if you want to do a reciprocal IVF, you're going to have to go abroad. We were devastated, but in true fashion, especially for me, when I'm told no, I'll just find a way to do it. And we went and we researched, and I think within a couple of days we had booked like a call with a clinic in Barcelona, and we decided we were going to go to Spain and spend a month there and try to get pregnant that way. So that's what we did.
Like, it happened quickly.
So this was, I think in July was when we had the appointment in Dublin. and just, you know, trying to sync up cycles, and, you know, making sure that both of us were on folic acid and just doing all the prep kind of work.
Yeah.
We planned our cycle for September. So it was within a couple of months.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was really quick. Yeah.
Yeah. Because at that stage we were ready to get going.
Yeah.
We also had planned to get married in October, which is when we had originally started dating. But the, I don't know if you remember, but the marriage equality legislation was delayed a little bit with being commenced.
That's
so
right,
it passed
yeah.
in May and it was supposed to be commenced by September, I think. Mm. It was like late that year.
Okay, yeah.
So we had planned our wedding for October and it wasn't going to be. And we were like, we're not going to have a ceremony and it's not legal. So we just said, look, we'll try for the baby first and then we'll get married in the spring, which is what we did. So we went to Barcelona and we spent a month there. We didn't really tell anyone what we were doing. We had no idea what we were doing because there was no information. There was literally nowhere to go. We didn't know any gay parents. We didn't know anyone even who had just done IVF. We had no idea what reciprocal IVF entailed. There was like just no information from within Ireland that we could access. We just had no idea what we were doing. And we, you know, dealing with a language barrier with this foreign clinic, and they were trying to send us, you know, and anyone who's gone through a fertility kind of journey and fertility treatment knows that like the medication and the schedules you have to stick to are really complicated sometimes. And they would be sending us these prescriptions. We were going to our GP and asking them to translate them onto an Irish script so we could actually get the medications that we needed. There were so many things that we made mistakes with, and I don't know how it all turned out so well because there were so many mishaps along the way, but we kind of bumbled our way through it, and we're just really, really lucky that, so basically reciprocal IVF is a standard IVF cycle split between two partners with the addition of donor sperm.
So am I right in thinking then Audrey's doing the injections?
And the egg collection, yep.
The egg collection.
And then
this is where you take over then?
And then I take over. I would also have done injections and hormones to prepare my body for an embryo transfer. So instead of her having, you know, one person having to go through both the egg collection, and that really is the hard part of IVF, it's kind of split. So then obviously I go through the hormones to kind of prepare the womb for a potential baby. Obviously, actually having the baby is the hard part.
But in saying that, it is beautiful to hear that. It was really, I mean, straight away, you're setting it out. We are a team. We're going to do this together. We're going to share the experience.
Yeah. And it was a very shared experience because I know for a lot of same sex or LGBTQ plus couples, if one partner is undergoing all the treatment, it can feel isolating for the other parent or partner. But for us, it was very much a shared experience. And when we did it the first time, no one knew. So that was kind of really special. The second time around, everyone knew because I was blogging about it.
Yeah.
But the first time around, no one knew, which was lovely.
So, I mean, when you came home then, hello, we're back, we're about to get married and we're pregnant.
So what happened was we did this cycle.
Yeah.
We got 10 eggs. We got 7 embryos.
Mm.
And then we transferred 2. I did get pregnant, but I had very, very early miscarriage within a couple of weeks. Mm. We kind of weren't expecting that. Like, I think everyone goes into, you know, trying to get pregnant in whatever way that might be. And you go into it thinking it's just going to happen.
It's going to happen, yeah.
And we just thought, because we didn't have any fertility issues, you know, we just were like, yep, we're going to do this embryo transfer. I'm going to get pregnant. It's going to work. We weren't really expecting that. So that kind of blindsided us. But at the same time, we were very much in that mode of let's just keep going. So that's what we did. I had to come off all the medication and we had to wait another month. So
did you stay in?
No. So okay, by that stage we were home, you know, so we came home pretty much after the embryo transfer, you know, the kind of the long process is the ovarian stimulation and the egg collection. That's kind of what takes the longest.
Yeah.
So by that stage we were home and Audrey was back in work. She had taken all the time off she could from work. and decided to go for a frozen embryo transfer. We still had 5 embryos left. I flew over. I actually was doing a gig the night before in November. No one knew again that I was going over to Barcelona the next morning. I flew on a Ryanair flight on a Thursday morning, got there, got booked in, stayed in a hotel, had the embryo transfer by myself on the Friday morning, and then flew home at the dinner time flight, a Ryanair dinner time flight on the Friday. That's how I got pregnant with Ava. And I always think that's funny. I got pregnant with my wife's baby when she wasn't even the same country as me.
Yeah. It's amazing. As you said, I mean, science is a beautiful thing.
It is. So then that was the end of November. So I suppose
you must have been scared though on your own, were you? Or are you just strike me as very, you go and get stuff done.
Yeah.
You're that kind of person.
And you know what? At that stage, so I'm also a type 1 diabetic.
Okay.
That is a whole other kind of story and journey. But I was only diagnosed when I was 25, 26, I was diagnosed, and had a kind of near-death experience in Sydney. I had been undiagnosed for about a year, and it was when I had begun recovering from my eating disorder. And I suppose I was not diagnosed because a lot of the people who were seeing me knew my history, and a lot of the symptoms of type 1 diabetes can sometimes mimic eating disorder behavior, you know. So I was losing weight again. Okay. I was just acting weird all the time. I was tired all the time. I couldn't concentrate on things. And it was essentially just dismissed because of my history. The only person who knew something was wrong was Audrey, because she was the one who lived with me. She knew that I was actually doing really well with my mental health.
Yeah. Okay.
And she knew something was not right. But yeah, when we were in, we traveled to Australia for the first time, and the trip just did me in. And I hear that from a lot of people who are diagnosed. I've actually met a lot of people who are diagnosed in Australia after undergoing, you know, because it's such a trek to get over there.
Yeah.
And whatever it is about traveling when you're in that state of undiagnosed type 1 diabetes, like your blood sugar is just climbing and climbing and climbing, and you go into a thing called DKA, which is a diabetic ketoacidosis, which basically your body starts poisoning itself. And I was kind of at that point before we flew, and then when we flew, it pushed me over the edge, and Audrey got me into an emergency room in Sydney. And I don't remember, I went into a coma and was in a coma for 2 days.
Oh my god,
it was crazy. Yeah. And they said if she hadn't got me in when she did, like, I would either have permanent brain damage or I just wouldn't be here. So from that experience, and then following on from that, I have a lot of experience being in the hospital, having to go to appointments, dealing with pain, you know, just from various different things. I'm used to that kind of environment of having to go for
now
procedures.
Yeah.
And also just in general, I think with the types of people we are, like if I'm in pain, I'll kind of suck it up and get on with it. Audrey's like a bear when she's in pain. And she will tell you that, you know, which also kind of just made sense when we were talking about like who would carry a baby. It just made sense that it would be that it would be me, you know. She's really good at taking care of me when I'm in pain and stuff. So yeah, no, I think.
So am I right in thinking that when you're in pain, is it do you internalize it? As in, is it I just need to bite my lip here and suck it up, rather than scream and roar as other people would be external about
absolutely,
pain?
Absolutely. Like even in labor, I don't think I ever, like I just did it. I just got those babies out, you know.
You didn't
moan
or scream?
No, I definitely like had like noises I would make, and like maybe I would have a lot of music on going, but I never screamed, because to me that was like that's not a positive energy for me. So like yeah, for me, like listening to all the shouting and roaring, and I'd be there just like like really quiet. Yeah, that's definitely the type of person I am. I would definitely internalize it.
Like that's fascinating.
Even last week, I was in so much pain. I've done something to my neck recently and I was in so much pain and I had to record an episode for my own podcast, and everyone knew how much pain I was in and everyone was like, Renee, we don't have to do this today. The world's not going to end. We can reschedule. And I was like, nope, we're doing it. I can't move my neck and I'm going to move like this, but we're still doing it. You know, I'm one of those people who just kind of likes to get things done.
Mm.
Yeah. Which is probably something I need to work on, you know, being a little bit easier on myself.
Well, perhaps, but it's also, I mean, it's a pretty amazing quality to have as well, to be that like Trojan about things and have that like, I'm going to get through this. So you can kind of probably deal with anything because you've been through so much already.
I feel like the things that we have been through, like myself personally and then as a couple, I feel like there's literally nothing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's the little things now that faze me because I've dealt with so many big things.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's nothing that you could throw at me. This is like me inviting the universe. This is me like, come at me.
I know. I feel that too, actually. No, look, I think you've certainly ticked enough boxes for the moment in terms of challenge in your life. So I think, you know, smoother days ahead would be welcome, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, you come back on the Ryanair flight in the evening on a Friday.
Yeah.
And
I tested a week later. Okay. So you're not supposed to test for 2 weeks. You're not supposed to test at all at home if you've done IVF. You're supposed to go back to the clinic. Obviously, we couldn't, but I was supposed to go to my GP to get a blood test.
I'm sure everybody tests.
Everybody tests. Okay. Like, anyone who says they don't is just completely lying. And Audrey would always be like, don't test without me. You know, I would always test without her.
Would you?
Because I wanted to know, like, I just, before, like, if we were disappointed, I just wanted to kind of prepare for her disappointment.
Okay.
You know, so I always did. So
were you feeling that sense of responsibility?
Yeah, because definitely I think whoever carries the baby feels that responsibility, and if it doesn't work, you feel like that weight is on you.
And of course you had already experienced an early miscarriage as well, so you'd had that.
So I just wanted to know, but I also really felt like it had worked. Felt like I was pregnant, so I got one of the clear blue tests that say, you know, how many weeks or whatever, and I remember doing it, and it was a Saturday morning, first pee of the day, and it immediately came up like pregnant. And I went back into her, and she just knew. She looked at me. She's like, "You did a test, didn't you?"
Yeah.
And we were just so delighted. Aww. Yeah. So thankfully, the pregnancy was fairly uncomplicated. I mean, I'm a type 1 diabetic, so I was in a lot. I had a lot of appointments. You know, being pregnant almost became like a full-time job for me with the amount of appointments I had to attend.
I can imagine.
So you
had constant blood tests, I would have said.
Constant. And I was constantly like being weighed and, you know, just monitored. And yeah, it was tough in that respect. Like it was an uncomplicated pregnancy, as in nothing went wrong. But it was tough from the management side for me. And also, you know, I was a fairly new diabetic, so my...
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
My blood sugar was just all over the shop. Any sort of hormonal shift really affects your blood sugar levels. I wasn't on a pump, an insulin pump. I didn't have a CGM, which is an amazing thing, which basically monitors your blood sugar every couple of minutes, and it will send my blood sugar level to my pump. It will like alert me if I'm going low. So I have all this amazing technology now that I didn't have for my first pregnancy.
Okay.
So I was basically like finger pricking every like 20 minutes. My fingers were like black and blue through that pregnancy because I was just constantly going low, going high.
God love you, yeah.
Yeah, it was really difficult. And then obviously just with it being the first pregnancy and you have no other experience, you know, to measure it against, it was difficult, but we were also just so incredibly grateful to be pregnant and just so happy, and we didn't know any better, so...
Ignorance of this.
Yeah,
sometimes
a little bit. Yeah, so we ended up, we actually had to, I was an inpatient. They had admitted me for like weird blood sugar levels, and we had to sneak me out to go do the registry office part of the wedding.
No.
Yeah, because we were getting married in March.
Yeah,
and we had to do the legal bit in February, and I just happened to have been admitted, and I was like, so they snuck me out, like they came and got me and snuck me out, and myself and Audrey and her parents.
How did you manage? Just like, I don't know, a sheet across the nurse's station.
I literally just said, I'm going out, I'm going across the road. You know, things were a lot more lax back then in the rotunda. I was like, yeah, I'm going across to the ILAC. Yeah, I'm just going to shop. I went and got married and then came back.
Hey, yeah. I got a pack of biscuits and a wife.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
That's so brilliant.
So, yeah, we got married in March of 2016. So at that stage, I was around 5 months pregnant. The dress was a nightmare.
Was it?
Because we had to keep having fittings because I just didn't realize how quickly a bump could show up.
Okay, and they kept having to let it out, was it?
Yeah, and then I ended up having to change the dress at the last minute because the dress couldn't be let. I had like my fairy tale gown, you know, it was like beautiful gown. It had pockets. It was just like that kind of real Cinderella kind of.
Yeah.
And with the bump, it just wasn't going to work. So we ended up having to go for like kind of a fitted mermaid kind of style, which was lovely because you could see the bump. But it definitely wouldn't be what I would have chosen were I not pregnant. But you know what? I actually didn't care. I was so chilled out. I did not care. I think I was just so flooded with like happy hormones that I was like, I don't care. It doesn't matter. I could just buy something from Penny's and we'll go get married. It doesn't matter. Like I so was not the kind of bride that I thought I would be.
Okay.
You know, because I am like, I like to be in control of things. Mm. I like things to go to plan. I like to have a plan. But I was so chilled out about it. I was like, it doesn't matter. It's okay.
Yeah. I suppose those second trimester hormones and they kick in.
Yeah.
I know it's not the same for everyone and every pregnancy is different, but a lot of women will experience that shift from the first trimester to the second.
I suppose at the time, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, we just thought everything was great and that we were not going to be facing additional challenges once our child was born.
Mm-hmm.
We just thought, this is amazing. We're married. We're having a baby. We are like everybody else now.
Because Ireland has opened
equal.
Up. We said yes to marriage equality. It's all good. Okay. Yeah. So you're married. You go on to have your gorgeous baby girl, Ava.
Yeah, in August.
In silence.
In silence.
In silence. In silence. So anyway, you have your gorgeous baby girl. And this is a pivotal moment for you guys when you go in to register her birth.
So I suppose going into like the last kind of weeks before she was born, we had kind of heard, and as I said before, we didn't know any other gay parents, you know, so we didn't know any other people in the same situation, but we started kind of connecting with some people online at that time, and there was more kind of openness around, you know, this topic. And we heard that only the person who would give birth would be actually a legal parent, and we just couldn't get our heads around that. We were like, but how? Like, you know, no, like we're married. We're married. Like,
yeah, it was Audrey's egg.
It was Audrey's egg and we're married.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Just no. Like if I was married to a man, they would just be the father or the parent, whatever. Like,
mm-hmm.
we just couldn't get our heads around it. And so we did know prior to her being born that this was going to happen, and we had gone to a solicitor and we had learned about this. But I suppose the day it became very real to us was the day that we registered her birth, because I've heard so many parents talking about that day as being like one of the days they remember forever. It's one of the days up there with the wedding, up there with the birth, whatever, those really special days that you treasure. And you go in, you know, if you're in Dublin, you go into Lombard Street and then you go for a coffee and a cake afterwards. And it's just a really happy time because, you know, that's your little person that you've brought into the world. Yeah, officially.
Yeah.
For us, we went into the office together. We were really kind of down already before going in because we knew only I'd be on the birth cert. But it just became very real when we were sitting there. And we're sitting there with all these other parents and their babies, and we kind of didn't even talk. We were just sitting there with our newborn, just really defeated about the whole thing. We went into the office with the registrar, and she was just very quite clinical about it. And she said, okay, right, which one is the mother? And we were like, we both are.
Both are, yeah.
We both are.
Yeah.
And she's like, no. I mean, which one gave birth? Which one of you gave birth? And I said, I did.
Oh, she just like that?
Yeah. Just like that. Which one of you gave birth?
Wow, okay.
There was no kind of preamble about, look, I'm sorry, I know you're married, I know, you know, this is your job. There was none of that. It was just, which one of you gave birth? I said, I did. And she said, okay, Renee, I'm going to be just directing all my questions at you now. And did not look at Audrey at all. God. Didn't look at her, didn't include her in the conversation. And yes, I know it's just filling out a form and, you know, just asking you all these questions. But at the same time, it was just really weird. It was just not
showing any compassion
at all.
Because clearly, as you said, you were going into it already knowing it was going to be difficult. But
it was just made a lot worse. It was just a really horrible experience. And, you know, after we left that day, even the person behind the desk who was actually the secretary and who just printed out the cert, they showed us more compassion. They kind of handed us the cert and they're like, really sorry.
Yeah, okay. Because even that, I mean, you know, they can't change the rules as they are. But, you know, it's important to show decency and be kind, particularly in a situation like that feels extremely unfair.
Yeah, and it was extremely unfair. And after we left that day, Audrey said, I never want to do that again. So we did it, when we had to do it the second time for Aria, I went by myself. I went by myself with her because I was registering as a single parent. And that's essentially what I was doing. You know, she couldn't do that again.
A single parent.
Yeah.
It's so messed up.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And what I find just really hard to kind of contend with, I suppose, is that people don't know, you know. And I've you know, so that was, you know, Ava will be 5 this year. Since she has been born, I have been banging on about this nonstop. Like, we went on I think our first TV appearance was like Ireland AM when she was maybe 2 or 3 months old. We have done countless, you know, film, just all of these mediums. I talk about it constantly on my socials. I'm writing articles about it, and I, you know, I've spoken at Pride numerous times, and still people don't know about it. Still people think that we live in an equal Ireland where Ireland said yes 6 years ago and everything has been sorted for the gays.
Yeah, okay.
And it really, really hasn't.
Yeah,
you know.
And it's a head in the sand stuff. It's just easier to not see.
Yeah.
See it.
Yeah, and I understand. And I understand that people want to focus on the positive news stories. But this is something
that's important to be real too.
It really,
isn't it?
It really is.
And that, you know, that we're all seen.
Yeah. Like, I literally could have gone in with a stranger on the street, like if they were male.
Yeah.
Could have picked anyone and said, come on in. I'll put you on birth cert. You know, so it's been a clear discrimination against our children because of the sex of their parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now, as we are today, there have been steps taken and some children now have equality, but most still don't. Most children of LGBTQ+ families still don't have equality. And also, This is only like a statistic I saw recently. 1 in 6 heterosexual couples need AHR, like assisted human reproduction assistance to have their families. 1 in 6. It's a huge number of
people. It is,
people.
Yeah, yeah.
Ireland has a huge rate of surrogacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a family who has conceived a child through surrogacy would be in a similar position to many LGBTQ plus families, where, you know, a surrogate is given parental rights and not the mother.
Yeah.
You know, and it all comes back to the Irish constitution of what a mother is. And a mother is deemed to be a person who gives birth. Yeah. And that's in our constitution. So that's what's caused so many hardships for families.
Mm-hmm.
And needless, you know, there are so many other things that I would love to be fighting for and, you know, advocating for, but we're having to fight for just something that's so basic, so basic to just have a legal connection to your parent. And it's not about, you know, pretending that there was no donor involved in the conception. It's not about hiding anything from children. It's not about trying to falsify birth certificates. But in Ireland, the way to have parental connection with your child is through the birth certificate, you know, and mm-hmm. if you're not on the birth cert, you don't exist. So it's just about trying to protect children and give them the protections that all of other children have.
And that's why you're doing this. You're doing this for your two girls.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what does it mean? I mean, Audrey's not recognised.
No. So currently she still is considered a legal stranger. And if I wanted to go, like, I have dual nationality, and if I wanted to take the kids to America tomorrow and say bye, I could. She has no legal connection to them.
Wow.
The steps that have been made in recent years are, you know, and a lot, maybe people listening will be kind of, no, but I heard that that changed, because there has been some change. The change is that there's a piece of legislation called the Children and Family Relationships Act that finally came into effect last May. And what that means is if you are a female couple and you meet the criteria listed in that piece of legislation, you can both go on the birth cert. But you have to be a female couple, you have to have done fertility treatment in an Irish clinic, you have to have used an identifiable sperm donor, and the child has to be born in Ireland. So if you fall outside of that at all, you're still not equal.
Which you guys do, because you obviously did your treatment abroad.
So with our particular situation, it's a little bit more complicated. In that, if for conceptions before May of last year, so if you have, if you meet most of the criteria, but say you had an anonymous donor, or if you used a foreign clinic, but your children were conceived before May of last year, there's an amnesty for those kids. So
okay,
technically our kids should have the amnesty, and we should be able to go to court to get a declaration of parentage for Audrey. It's been a bit more complicated in that we brought a case against the state because they were not including reciprocal IVF in this piece of legislation.
Okay.
It was excluded. We spent a year and a half dealing with this case. And, you know, there was a good outcome in that they have now included reciprocal IVF in this piece of legislation. We have not been able to complete the re-registration of our kids because of that other court case. So it's just made things more complicated for us. It's been a bit of a catch-22 for us.
Okay.
We are hopeful that we'll be able to resolve our legal situation soon for these two girls. But if we use any of our embryos that we still have abroad, they won't be covered because they will be after May 2020. So we could be in a really weird situation where we finally get the rights for our existing kids.
Yeah.
But if we choose to have another child, which we are pretty sure we're going to do, those children or child will not be covered, even though they would be genetically identical.
So bizarre.
It's really bizarre. But regardless of whether or not our children are covered, I just don't believe that, you know, the fight, it will ever be over until everyone is treated the same. Like, why would one child who is conceived in a clinic
mm-hmm.
be eligible for a legal connection to their parents and a child who's conceived at home through intracervical insemination or home insemination, why would they not be allowed to have a legal connection with their parents? Or why should a child born through surrogacy to two gay dads or to, you know, to a parent, why should they have less rights than a child? You know, we need to stop looking at how children were conceived and where they were born, and was it in Ireland or was it in the north? Or, you know, children need to have a legal connection to the people who are raising them and who are their parents. Mm. They should also have access to their genetic heritage. I completely agree. But they need to have, you know, safety within their family life. Yeah.
And love, and the key ingredients that every child needs and is important growing up is what, you know, you're providing yourselves at home in your family unit.
Yeah.
And they're the most important things. Now, there's so many questions are coming into my mind that I'm imagining people listening may be curious about and be wondering about. So a few of them are. So Ava is going to be 5 this year. And Aria, is she 2?
She's 2 and 3 months.
Okay, yeah. So both, you went to different clinics in different countries for both, simply because things became a little bit tricky in Barcelona?
Yeah, we had gone back to try and conceive a second child. We had a transfer that didn't work, and then we lost an embryo, and then we were going to have to start from scratch again, and we just weren't completely happy with our clinic. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's really important for anyone going through fertility treatment, is that you're really comfortable with your the people who are treating you, and that you just feel kind of at home. And we didn't feel that anymore. And at the time, reciprocal IVF still wasn't legislated or licensed for here. It is now for anyone wishing to avail of it. Many of the clinics are offering it now. So we still needed to go abroad, and we just looked at loads of different clinics, and we just got a really good feeling about this one in Portugal that we ended up going to. It's called Fertocentro. It is in a small town called Coimbra. And it was a beautiful experience. It was completely different because we were going with a 1.5-year-old this time. Wow. So it was not relaxing at all.
Yeah.
not like when we went to Barcelona and we were walking on the beach every day. And, you know, it was not relaxing, but it was still lovely. And the clinic were just gorgeous. And so if we go again, we'll be going back to them.
Because you have your
Our embryos are there. Yeah.
Yeah. How many do you have?
We have 3 left.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So we would be hopeful that we would be successful again if we tried again.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we will. You know, we talk about it every day. Last night we were lying in bed and we were watching something on the laptop, like Grey's Anatomy, and there was like a baby being born or something. And Audrey's like, aren't we? You know, we go back and forth, because a lot of days we're just literally crying at each other. Like, I'm so exhausted.
This is so hard.
I'm so tired. When are we not going to be tired anymore? But like, that's just for a season, and then it passes.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's so hard having kids, but I kind of figure it's already hard, you know?
Yeah.
And we just love them so much, and they just give us so much happiness. They really do. They're just so beautiful. Like, we're obsessed with our kids. We love them.
Well, I follow you on Instagram and I see your stories, and they are just divine. Yeah. And they laugh.
They laugh so much.
Yeah. They look like the happiest girls I've ever seen.
They are so happy. And they obviously, you know, all kids have their own little kind of struggles. And Ava definitely is going through some kind of anxiety issues.
Okay.
But she also is just so happy when it's the 4 of us. Like, and she adores her sister. And yeah, she's very happy. Audrey's just a big kid. So she just makes them laugh. Like, right before bedtime, she riles them up. And I'm like, babe, enough.
Yeah.
I'm like,
we need them to sleep.
3 of you sit down on the couch now.
So both, you went the same process with both, reciprocal IVF. Yeah. So Audrey's eggs for both Ava and Aria.
Yes.
And anonymous sperm donors.
Yes, because that has changed now. So at one point in time, in most countries, only anonymous donation was allowed. The kind of the school of thought has changed in recent years, in that, you know, children should have access to their genetic heritage. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. But at the time, that was all that was available. You weren't allowed to get non-anonymous donation.
Yeah, okay.
That has changed now, I think, both in Spain and Portugal. It has changed now. And in Ireland, as of May last year, only identifiable. So there's three types of donors. You can get a known donor, which is maybe a friend who agrees to be your donor. Then you can have an anonymous donor, which means you don't know who they are, the clinic doesn't know, and you know, you can never access their information. And then identifiable means that you don't know who they are, clinic doesn't know, but their details are held on a register, and at the age of 18, the child conceived through that donation can access that if they want to. So that going forwards, that's the only type of donors that are allowed in Ireland and in most countries.
Yes. But now that you still have your three embryos, they are presumably with the same sperm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's still
anonymous. Yeah. But do you know what? I don't think there is such a thing as anonymous anymore. There are so many websites you can go for, like DNA tests, and you can find, you know, there are all these sorts of kind of services where people can find donor siblings, you know.
Okay, yeah.
And I just don't think anything is truly anonymous anymore. I think if you really wanted to track, you know, genetic heritage, I think there will be a way to do that now and definitely in the future.
Mm. Yeah, with the way science is moving. Do you think it will be something, like, is it something that you guys have spoken about?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Oh, definitely. It's definitely something. And do you know, Ava loves telling everyone her birth story.
Okay.
And the way she tells it is so funny. She just, like, we've talked about this with her very openly from the time she was born. And it's definitely, you know, something that is needed, that there needs to be more, like, children's literature in the area. Mm. I actually have a book that I am kind of in the process of trying to write.
Great.
I think kids need to be educated on all the different ways that families are created and, you know, the non-traditional methods that are used.
Yes.
And it's really important to start that early, because then it's not a big deal at all. You know, we've always told her that she was an egg that was in mom's tummy, and then we went to a special place and, you know, we used a donor sperm, and she knows all of these phrases.
Great, yeah.
And recently she started talking about it all the time to anyone who will listen. She'd be like, yeah, and when I was born and I was in mom's tummy, and then the doctor took me, and then I was an embryo, and then I was in mama's tummy, and then she was trying to push me out and I got really big, and then I was getting tired. And she, like, recounts the whole labor. And then the doctor needed to help to pull my head out because it was too big. She loves it. But she just loves the fact that she was in mom's tummy and then she was in mama's tummy.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know.
So mom is Audrey and you're mama.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's brilliant.
Yeah, but no, I think it's really important to talk to kids about how they were born. And I do, it is definitely something
We haven't gone there now with our little boy, but you make me think.
Yeah, like, there's no harm, even if you think they're not taking it in, they are.
Yeah.
You know, they understand a lot more than what we give them credit for. And I think that, that's definitely something we worried about when we were starting the process. We were like, will our kid hate us because we have an anonymous donor and they can't access that information? Will they hate us? Will they be like, you ruined my life, I want access to this information? And then at the time we were like, well, do you know what, this is the only option open to us. And our kid's gonna find some way to hate us.
Yeah.
And we're gonna screw them up in some way.
So true.
So this is just gonna be one of the ways she's gonna blame us for something.
It'll just be an easy target. Yeah.
We didn't have a choice in the matter. And, you know, it is what it is. Like, we'll have those conversations when we get there, and it will be something we have to all navigate. And one of them might be interested, one of them may have no interest. You just don't know how someone's going to react. And I think the best policy is to just have open communication.
Yes, exactly. And once they know that you're open about it and honest.
Yeah.
And you're not hiding anything, that's really healthy. And have you been able to connect with other couples and families who have been through similar experiences as yourselves?
In Ireland.
Anywhere.
So, yeah.
But interestingly, how many are in Ireland?
Yeah, so I suppose when I started talking really publicly about this in 2016, I started kind of slowly connecting with other families in Ireland who had been, you know, had had their children either through surrogacy or through IVF or through non-clinical methods, and started kind of building ourselves a little tribe of people, which is really nice. And we have some really close friends now who have kids and all around the same age. And it's really important to me that our kids have, you know, see families like their own.
Yeah.
And I suppose that got a lot bigger in 2019 because myself, along with many other kind of families in the same situation, we formed a campaign group called Equality for Children. Mm. And we set up that campaign, I suppose, with the view to doing, you know, what Yes Equality did for marriage equality, you know, a campaign yeah. group that was dedicated solely to one issue, and that one issue is achieving equality for all children born to LGBTQ plus families in Ireland. So we've been going since 2019. I'm the CEO. It's my non-official full-time job.
Yes,
yeah. That doesn't pay me anything. Mm. It's a lot of work, but it's also very rewarding. Because it's really kind of brought a community together, and we have, you know, just connected with so many people,
yeah.
and, you know, Irish people living abroad who are in a situation where they want to come home, but if they come home, their children won't be legally connected to them, or they're living abroad and they can't get their kids' passports because the parent who gave birth is not Irish, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a very broad issue, and it's very challenging.
Mm-hmm. What can we do? What can yeah. people listening do to make a difference? Because I know yeah. it's about signing petitions, and awareness is a huge mm. part of this, because as you said, so many people still don't realise
yeah.
that this is the case. But on a practical level, what can we do?
So I always say to people that, like, one of the biggest challenges I face in the work that I do is, you know, the awareness side of things, because people don't know. And if people don't know, people can't get mad about it. They can't do anything to yeah. change it.
Mm-hmm.
So if people are not talking about this, and that's something that I do, and I actually work with a lovely lady called Lucy in Artisan PR. She does all our PR and she does it pro bono, and she literally has been for the last 2 years trying to keep this in the media. And it's really hard because people want good news stories and people want, you know, something new, and it's like we're in the same situation that we've been in, you know, and so it's hard to keep it current,
the momentum going.
Yeah, it's hard because we're constantly trying to put a new spin on things so that people will get talking about it again. But it is so important. Like, we're nearly 6 years on. We're
yeah.
6 years on from marriage equality, and we don't have equality, but most people think we do. So I think the biggest thing that people can do is to raise awareness within their own circle and their own network. So if, you know, you're a person with a big family, get onto your family WhatsApp and start
yeah.
a conversation about this and say, hey, did you know this was happening?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you care about it? And I kind of believe if you are someone who is either within the queer community, or you are someone who claims to be an ally, or you're someone who voted yes. If you are someone who voted yes, this is your issue.
Yeah, okay.
You know?
Yes.
And 63% of the country voted yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that if every one of those people knew that this was what was happening, they'd be up in arms, surely, because this is not equality.
Because you're right, when you think about it, we all got behind it.
Yeah.
Those of us who believed mm-hmm. that we wanted, you know, marriage equality mm-hmm. for all, we really did get behind it.
Really?
In
it was
a huge way.
Like, if you remember Dublin Castle.
Oh, yeah.
May 6 years ago.
So powerful.
So powerful. And people just don't know this is happening, so they can't do anything about
mm-hmm.
it. So we need people to know this is happening.
And not to limit it, but it's almost like it's even more.
It's more important.
These are kids.
I would prefer to have equality for my kids
yeah.
than to have equality for me and my wife. Honestly, mm-hmm. I would, because it's about protecting them.
Yeah, and how can you protect yourselves? I mean, the way it is right now, you're the one on the birth cert. You're the one being recognised. Can you protect yourselves through, like, I don't know, writing of a will, or
yeah,
what
so
can you do?
You can do a couple of things. You can write a will. You can get guardianship of a child, but you can only get guardianship after you've lived with a child for 2 years. So if you don't qualify under the current legislation, so if you're not female, haven't done treatment in a clinic in Ireland, child wasn't born in Ireland. If you don't meet that criteria, you can get guardianship, but only after a kid turns two. And right. for anyone who's a parent, you know that most of like the medical things and the things that of you need to give consent for happen in the first 2 years.
Yes, yeah, of course.
And only the legal parent can do all those things. So the burden falls onto one person, you know, to do all of that. But yes, you can absolutely get guardianship after a child turns two. But really what we need to be doing is just fighting for full equal rights for everybody.
Yes.
And we actually are at a really exciting point in time right now, because it has taken a year, but a report was completed by appointed by the government. The special children's rapporteur, his name is Professor Conor O'Mahony. He was appointed to do a really in-depth piece of research around the gaps in the legislation, all the children who fell between the cracks, looking at assisted human reproduction. So looking at the LGBTQ plus community, how we have our families, and also those 1 in 6 heterosexual families who need AHR2. So it heavily focuses on surrogacy, but also looks at lots of other things like non-clinical conceptions within the LGBTQ plus community. That report was finished in December, so it took a full year, and it was published a couple of weeks ago. Now, the report was more than what we could have asked for. It has everything we wanted in it. All of the recommendations kind of provide clear legal solutions to cover all families.
Okay.
What we need is for the government to accept their own report that they commissioned.
Yes.
To say, okay, you are the expert. You have looked at this from a child's rights point of view. We are going to accept your recommendations and we're going to adopt them into the AHR bill going forwards. And we're going to do that very quickly. That's what we need them to do. So there's a lot happening at governmental level. There are meetings going on behind the scenes. We have some very strong allies in certain departments.
Good.
Minister McEntee is a very strong ally.
Yeah.
She will be going on maternity leave soon. So we're trying to kind of make things happen quickly.
Yeah.
And set up a cross-departmental approach, because this is not going to lie with any one department. It's going to be across a lot of departments. What we have done is we've started a new petition in the last week and a half, basically calling on the health department and the Minister for Health to accept these recommendations and implement them. We're trying to get that petition to 20,000 signatures. We're hoping to meet with him and other departments in the next couple of weeks. It would be really great to have that to 20,000 before we meet, so we can go into the meeting and say we have the support behind us.
So this is where people listening,
you can actually do something.
Please.
And I know.
Yeah.
And
we're going to include this link in the show notes.
Yeah.
So all you'll have to do is click on it and sign your name. I signed my name a few weeks back.
Yeah.
It takes seconds.
Seconds. It's so easy. And it's so easy to get, like, you know, just set yourself a target. Get 10 of your friends to do the same.
Yeah.
10 of your family members to do the same. It's so easy to do. And I know that it's possible to do that. Like, I, a couple of years ago, started a petition. I got it to 20,000. And hours after I got it to 20,000, I had an email from the then Minister for Health, Simon Harris, because 20,000 seems to be the number, apparently. So I've heard. And there is power in numbers. And I know people get fatigued with the amount of petitions we're asked to sign, but it literally takes 2 seconds out of your day and it literally can make a change.
Yeah.
And for so long, we've been talking about this issue and there's been no real kind of clear pathway to achieve equality. But actually right now, it's really exciting because we do have a pathway. We've literally been handed a guidebook as such from an expert who says, OK, this is how it is. This is what we need to look at. This is what we need to be careful of. And this is how we fix it. We've literally been handed that.
Mm.
So all we need the government to do is to say, OK, yep. Let's take this and roll with it. But that's not going to happen without public pressure.
Sure.
Because there, you can bet your ass there's going to be pushback.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Yeah, there is.
You know, within certain departments and within, you know, certain people at certain levels will, there will be definite pushback on some aspects of that report. And, you know, there's always been pushback against surrogacy. So unless we have the support behind us, it's going to take a lot longer. And I just feel like we're literally just at this moment in time where we actually can change something.
Yeah.
But we need people's help to do that.
Yes. Yes, you do. I just appeal to anyone listening who has listened to this conversation, has connected with you and your family. And if you're anyway like me and you're just thinking, God, this is just basic humanity. All kids deserve, and their parents deserve it. They deserve this connection. So I think it's just appealing to people's good nature. As you said, it only takes a few seconds and it's your good deed done.
Yep.
For the day or the week or the month or whatever way you want to look at it.
Yep.
We are an incredibly generous people. We see it all the time with our big, you know, charity campaigns. The Late Late Show will do an item and then it's next thing. It's, you know, we've raised 500,000. We've raised 1 million, 2 million, 3 million.
Yep.
We are bloody brilliant at getting behind things.
When we know about it.
When we know about it.
Yeah. Yep.
So now we know.
Yeah.
When we know better, we do better.
Exactly.
I was just thinking about, you know, couples, relationships, they can be challenging at the best of times. Mm. But you've had all of this to contend with as well. I would imagine, does that cause friction at times within your own relationship? Because this is not your doing.
Yeah.
It's an outside thing that is infiltrating the dynamic of being parents to your children.
It's been incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And it's something that I hugely resent. And I have a lot of anger over it. I have a lot of anger at what this has done to our family and to our relationship.
Yeah.
Like, we are still very much a team and we're very much together in everything we do. But this has really taken its toll on us. It's taken its toll on me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm, you know, I get to a point where I just hit a wall and I'm just exhausted. I'm exhausted from just saying the same thing over and over and over and over.
And having to fight.
And having to fight for something that I shouldn't have to fight for.
Yeah.
I always call myself an accidental activist, but I also call myself an exhausted activist. And I think anyone who has been involved, you know, I speak to a lot of people who've been involved in like the repeal campaign, and years on, they're suffering the kind of the trauma from it. You know, the difficulty of going through campaigning for something that you shouldn't have to campaign for, something that you shouldn't have to tell your personal story over and over again.
Yes.
You shouldn't have to put your family on show.
And that's what you're doing. You're having to share, which we've done through this conversation.
Yeah.
You've had to share very personal detail about, you haven't had to. You've done it because for the greater good.
Yeah.
You're doing it because you feel passionate about this. But it is putting you in a very difficult, draining situation. And I know from my own situation, completely different, but from speaking about past experience, be it miscarriage or otherwise, when you go back into the pain of it, you relive it again.
You do. And it's like, it's kind of like, for me at the moment, it's kind of just, I really relive it every day. I talk about it every day.
Yeah.
It's a part of my everyday. And that does cause issue, you know, in our relationship, because you know, Audrey just wants me to be okay. And she doesn't want to see me exhausted. And she doesn't want to see me fighting all the time. Like, I'm always on my phone.
Yeah.
And it's usually to do with this, you know, and it's usually because I'm, you know, responding to things, or I'm writing up press releases, or I'm, you know, I'm just constantly working. And, you know, she just, that's really hard, you know, and even just the fact, the imbalance in the relationship that has been created because I have had all of the rights, that in itself is hard, you know, if, you know,
imagine.
And I know, you know, a lot of heterosexual people could be in this similar situation where, you know, sometimes an unmarried father has no rights, you know, things like that. If they're not on the birth cert, or, you know, there can be loads of different situations where the power dynamic is out of whack.
Yeah.
And that in itself can cause issues, you know? So yes, it's been incredibly hard, and all, you know, I always say there's no way I'd still be doing this today if it wasn't so important. If it was anything else, I'd have passed it on to someone else. I'd have said, no, I can't do this anymore. I'm just hopeful that we can get there sooner rather than later, because I don't think I can do this for another 5 years.
Yeah,
I really don't think I have it in me. I mean, I would probably find it from somewhere, but you know, the thought of doing this for another 5 years is just not good.
No.
You know, I think I'll always be that person who likes to speak up for injustice that I see. That is just a part of who I am.
Yeah.
You know, I won't stay silent to kind of make friends with people. I'll, you know, call it as I see it. But I just wish that I could be putting my energy into something else that isn't just something that should be a given.
Yeah.
You know, so I look forward to the day when I can, you know, fight for other things.
Yes. Yeah. Or not fight at all.
Or not fight at all.
Or not fight at all.
I can't even imagine what that would feel like right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that would be my hope and prayer for you, that you get a break. You get a break, and you're given the opportunity to take a break and take a step back. Again, I suppose just to reiterate, the link is in the show notes. Please click in. Please sign. Thank you for listening to this conversation. And Renee, thank you so much for opening up and again sharing your experience. I fully appreciate that it ain't easy. And you know, you're a mom and you've two gorgeous girls and you want to have a nice life, and you do have a good life and a lovely life, but it's a huge drain on your energy and a lot of time. So yeah, thank you very, very much for this.
Thanks for having me.
Renee has her own podcast called Disordered, which explores a relationship with food and our bodies, and it's really worth checking out. And if you enjoyed this chat, please show your support by leaving a rating or a little comment on Apple, or by clicking follow on Spotify. Thank you so much for listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.